You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 16th of April 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Germany moves to partially lift its lockdown. We'll examine how the country tries to balance an economic desire to move with the imperative to save lives. Also ahead, South Korea's elections see a record turnout and an endorsement of the current policies of President Moon. Plus, Taiwan's former foreign minister explains why he thinks the rest of the world was too slow to react to the pandemic.
We feared that if the WHO took action a little bit earlier, probably the situation would be much better now for the entire world.
Plus, Google and Apple team up on contact tracing. We'll ask what happens when rivals decide to work together. Plus, the newspapers and the business news too. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in the news. President Donald Trump says the United States has passed the peak of new coronavirus cases and he will announce guidelines for lifting the US lockdown today. Asia's economic growth will grind to a halt this year for the first time in six decades. That warning comes from the International Monetary Fund. And Médecins Sans Frontières will for the first time work in Canada to help homeless people infected with coronavirus, opening a 400-bed facility in Toronto. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, Germany's shops and schools are to partially reopen as the aggressive lockdown imposed by many European countries is gradually lifted. Germany has been praised for its aggressive approach to the coronavirus, with widespread testing and protecting the vulnerable. It's resulted in fewer deaths compared with the likes of Spain and Italy. But Germany stands at the difficult point that every economy will face in all this. When is the right time to open up again? And is there such a thing as restarting an economy? Well, I'm joined by Anna Rosenberg, who's head of Europe in the UK at the political consultancy Signum Global. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Anna. Could you just briefly explain exactly what Germany's plans are?
Sure. So I think Germany is, firstly, there's going to be different measures implemented across the different states. It's not going to be uniform. Each state in Germany has the authority to implement the measures they see fit. So you're going to see some states opening up faster than others, for example, Nordrhein-Westfalen as well as Thuringia, while others like Bavaria are taking it somewhat more slowly. That has to do with the political priorities of the local government, really. So I think in some areas, for example, Nordrhein-Westfalen, they're quite keen to open up schools, especially in the more advanced classes, in order to allow students to really, finish their exams. And then you're also going to see the opening up of smaller shops up to 800 square meters. But really not a massive restarting of the economy that everyone is hoping for. It's a very slow opening of some key economic sectors, but nothing that will really kickstart the economy into full mode as we had seen before the crisis.
Let's examine a little bit more this idea that Germany is moving towards lifting the lockdown, but there still remain tensions among the different regions, with, as you say, the north very much pushing forward and Bavaria very much holding back. What problems does that cause?
Well, it will likely cause some grievances amongst people living in those states. I mean, if you remember a few weeks ago when the crisis started to emerge in Italy and the Italian government decided to just close down certain regions in the north of Italy, you had this massive push of people moving south and basically leaving those northern regions on lockdown. And I don't think we're going to see a repetition of that in Germany if some states open sooner than others, but there are going to be grievances in some states saying, hey, why can't we open these kind of shops here when they are opening in other member states? So there's going to be some tensions, and I think it'll ultimately lead to some erratic decision makings and some politicians feeling the pressure to need to move because of this pressure rather than because it's necessarily in the benefit of the population.
What is interesting is you have Angela Merkel saying we have a great shared feeling here in terms of the consensus among Germany's politicians. However, there is still jealousy, there are still power games, and that is it's an unfortunate thing, isn't it, when you still bring politics into something which effectively is dealing with people's lives and deaths.
Absolutely, but I think in Germany actually this is being dealt with much better than in most other European member states, really, where the pandemic is sitting quite badly. So what we've been saying for a while and what has been quite interesting is that when the pandemic really got bad, you saw a pulling together of opposition forces across European governments, which was remarkable. You saw governing coalitions in Spain and Italy and Germany that had been quite weak really strengthen through their response in the crisis, because the oppositions decided that now is not the time to criticize the government. And the same happened in Germany. If you remember, a few weeks ago, we were talking about early elections potentially in Germany, because the CDU-SPD coalition was really quite weak and in a bad situation. But the opposite has happened. Everyone pulled together, and they remain together in this, because at the moment, the crisis is fairly under control in Germany, and citizens are appreciating that. But there is a moment in time when there will be a fallout, and we are seeing this political fallout already in other countries. We're seeing it in Spain, where the opposition has started to attack the government. We're seeing it in Italy, where the truce also has broken down between the opposition and the government, and even tensions within the governing coalition. And eventually this is going to reemerge in Germany, although I think there is a bit more time here because Germany has been dealing with it so effectively. But don't forget, there are elections coming up in Germany next year, and there will be a point in time when you're going to see voices specifically from the FDP and to some extent from the Greens getting louder and basically crying out for failures committed by the government as well.
So you then have this issue that the loosening of restrictions, some argue, are a genuine move to get the economy moving in some way again. But others are saying that actually loosening the restrictions is a rather political gesture.
Well, it certainly is. And I think that's something that we're ignoring at the moment. But the disease is not over. The pandemic is still affecting, still thousands of people are dying every day. And it's around for a while until we find a vaccine or another medical solution. It will continue to dictate our daily lives. And a going back to normal will not be possible until a medical solution is found. So we are not talking about a restarting of the economy. We're talking about a very soft easing that is likely to be rolled back the moment you have new waves of infections. And so that means that we're now entering a new normal where social distancing remains the norm, where productivity will remain low because you can't send people back into factories working full time in masses. You need to keep on distance. You need to allow people to work in shifts so they can keep physical distance. But most importantly, and that's something not many people talk about, is European economies are dependent on supply chains, on the movement of goods and people across European member states. Now, we still have travel restrictions in place. We can't have people moving around. We can't have goods moving around. So even if you are a factory and you want to reopen your car plant, you can't, because you won't get your products that you need for producing those cars.
And how are the EU leaders managing this? I mean, there has been a torrent of criticism about the speed at which EU leaders have either worked or failed to work together. Now when we're lifting things up again, and you mentioned the fact that you cannot have free movement of goods, you cannot have free movement of people, it is a huge challenge.
Absolutely. And it's a very difficult thing to manage. I think that the EU Commission is trying to organize it somehow in trying to get member states to better coordinate with the EU Commission so that they can reintroduce gradual movement of people again and movement of goods, which is, you know, accelerating it and easing travel restrictions. But it is in a way artificial. Of course, the aim is going to be to look a little bit more organized, but ultimately it cannot fully reopen until the pandemic is under control. So it's a huge challenge for the European economies, and it's going to remain so until there is a medical solution for the pandemic.
We end up, therefore, looking at Brussels not only for money. I think Ursula von der Leyen has mentioned trillions of euros in investment to fund the recovery. But they've only just written their seven-year budget, haven't they? I mean, that will require an entire rewrite.
Yes, and they will. And it probably is a good thing that it will be, because that budget was not ambitious enough in the first place for some of the goals that the EU had anyway, specifically talking about its climate change ambitions, its climate goal ambitions. Now there is the political will to step up that budget and to really step up spending and investment in key areas. And I assume the recovery will be really tied to some of those green goals. Those won't go away. So it's going to take some time. It's going to take a lot of political wrangling, because if we've seen one thing over the last few weeks is that the north-south divide in Europe is still very real, and that is going to remain there, and it's going to continue to dictate the budget negotiations.
And it has happened that the coronavirus has actually almost observed that north-south divide, hasn't it? I mean, that makes things worse.
Yes, unfortunately, it has. Originally, we started the pandemic by assuming that no one is safe from the pandemic. Everyone will be hit by it to the same degree. It doesn't matter what class you are, how wealthy you are, what country you are. But actually, that's not true. We have seen that the pandemic clearly affects poorer countries and poorer segments of society more so than wealthier ones. And as such, you actually have a deepening of divisions rather than a pulling people together, unfortunately.
Anna Rosenberg, thank you very much for joining me. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Of all this, a democratic process continues. In South Korea, a general election has been held with astonishingly a record turnout, higher than any parliamentary elections in the country's democratic history. Widely seen as a referendum on the president's handling of the COVID-19 crisis, the results suggest his administration's strict policy of trace, test, treat has been both a medical and now a political success. To tell us more, joining me from Seoul is the journalist and contributing writer for Nikkei Asian Review, Stephen Borowitz. Stephen, very warm welcome to the programme. Just tell us who's won and by what margins, please.
Well, Moon's party, or is it called the Democratic Party? They're a left, kind of centre-left party. They've won 180 out of 300 seats in the legislature, which gives them a pretty decisive majority. And as you alluded to in the intro, it seems that the public was eager to reward Moon and his party for their effective handling of the response to the COVID-19 crisis. And looking ahead, this will now give Moon some pretty strong leeway to push ahead some of his major policy objectives. Moon's been trying to push for rapprochement with North Korea, and he's been trying to redistribute wealth through some progressive taxation and some ways of supporting small businesses and regular households. And so things are looking quite good for him now, and it looks like he'll, for the remainder of his five-year presidential term, there are 2 years left, he's going to be able to govern from a position of considerable strength.
That's interesting. For the first time, you're mentioning non-COVID-19 related issues that have driven politics for the last couple of months. I mean, you have to ask, had COVID-19 not happened, would President Moon's result be as successful as it is today?
Almost certainly no. But before the virus came along, these elections were set to be a kind of referendum on how Moon has handled the economy. And Moon has tried a different approach than his predecessors in government. He's tried to, his signature policy he has called income-led growth. And so what he's tried to do is boost household incomes, boost the fortunes of regular people and small and medium enterprises, and try to vitalize the economy me that way, instead of what a lot of South Korean governments have done, is try to make things easier on the big corporate conglomerates that run the country. And Moon has been operating from a place of sincerity. I think he really has been genuinely interested in trying to help out regular people. But the big major economic indicators like unemployment and GDP and things like that just had not really improved all that much. And Moon had therefore been pretty ripe for criticism from his conservative opponents, who would argue that he was messing up the economy and wasting taxpayer money. And obviously nothing good comes from COVID-19, but just strictly from Moon's perspective, the way that his government has overseen this effective handling that has garnered all kinds of positive attention from overseas, it definitely worked in his political favor.
So we now have the left-leaning Democratic Party winning an enormous number of seats. We also have a satellite party, I think it's called Together, isn't it? And this, for the first time, creates a very left-leaning parliament in South Korea. I think it's for the first time in almost 15, 16 years. What direction do you think that's now going to take South Korea?
Well, Moon will be able to continue with his economic policy. I think what this really means is Moon, we're not likely to see drastic policy shifts, but what tends to happen in South Korean politics is presidents serve in single five-year terms, and these elections take place about 3 years into their terms, and usually the ruling party doesn't do well in these elections, and usually what happens is they lose their majority, and that really kind of hampers what they can do in the legislature for the remaining of their terms. That hasn't happened with Moon, so Moon will be able to really double down and push for things like the redistribution of wealth. Another thing that he really wants to do is reform the prosecution in South Korea. The prosecution has traditionally been accused of being politicized and sort of being misused by right-wing administrations. So Moon really wants to limit what the prosecution can do. He wants to set up some new bodies that will change things in a more permanent way. And also Moon will try to, while he's in power, he'll try to achieve some kind of reconciliation with Korea that could last beyond his term. The problem with that is in recent months, North Korea has seemed really disinterested in cooperating with the South. But at the very least for Moon, he'll be able to keep doing what he was doing and not have to worry about meddling from the opposition too much.
That's the politics considered. Let us now move to the record turnout. This was an astonishing thing, wasn't it? Is it more than 60% turnout in the middle of a pandemic and masterclass, people are suggesting, in how to vote?
Yeah, I think that the COVID-19 crisis has really awakened a sense of civic duty among people here. I think that, you know, Korea has traditionally been this sort of collective society. You know, the word that Korean, when speaking Korean, the words that Koreans use for their country is Urinara, which translates as our country. And in recent weeks, given all, another thing that Koreans really love is positive attention from overseas. And so in recent weeks, with international bodies and other countries calling on South Korea for help with their own COVID outbreaks and kind of upholding Korea as a model, I think that was a really motivating factor. And just in terms of how the vote was carried out, I mean, nowadays in pretty much all public places in Korea, you're required to wear a mask. They have temperature, they have thermometers, they take everybody's temperatures. There's hand sanitizer on hand. So it wasn't too much of a stretch to carry out this vote in public places. The infrastructure was kind of already in place. And one thing that it seems like everybody could agree with, you know, regardless of how they were voting, was everybody really wanted this to go ahead, and they really wanted to have this gauge of how the government was doing, and people really wanted to come out and exercise their political franchise.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what messages this now gives to the rest of the world in terms of how you run an election, in terms of social distancing, masks, and how you actually get people excited about doing it.
Well, that varies from country to country. I mean, I'm from Canada, and I can't recall ever being in Canada at a time when people seemed really excited to vote. I mean, COVID-19, kind of in the same way that a war or an economic crisis would, it seemed to really draw a lot of attention to issues of public administration and really make people see that what a government does that can really affect their life. This was watching the South Korean government lead the response to this crisis really showed that governance is not always something that's abstract or something that the average person feels doesn't really affect their life. There was real life and death decisions being made. So I think in any country that has an election over the next year or two, I think is likely to see a spike in turnout because there are just more people paying attention and more people feeling like politics can really affect the way that they live.
Stephen Borowitz, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, we look at another nation which has set the standard when it comes to handling the coronavirus, Taiwan.
Currently, the coronavirus pandemic situation in Taiwan is under control. So far, we have had less than 400 confirmed cases and only 6 deaths.
We'll find out more from Taiwan's UK representative in just a moment. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
For Monocle's May edition, we hone in on the home. And as the world bunkers down, we explore the industries elevating domestic life and the brands making home a better place. Here we go. While lockdowns change the face of urban life globally, we hear from Monocle's bureau chiefs, who step away from the rolling news cycle to praise the resilience of the cities we call home. We maintain the momentum with our in-depth analysis of the businesses creating healthier dwellings, with fitness equipment, classes, and personal training being delivered direct to the living room. We question whether houses can ever really replace gyms. Worn out? Well, spend some time on the couch with us as we explore the streaming wars in a culture report that looks at the smart and agile smaller players in the world of media who are giving major streaming services a bit of a run for their money. Our home design manifesto serves up a choice selection of new furniture releases, as well as expert opinion on how to improve your home, making it a happier, healthier, and much more handsome place. Plus, we venture into some of Mexico City's most beautiful apartments, all designed by the mid-century maestro Mario Pani. And while the resort is a place we can only dream about right now, we serve up a reminder that the wait will be worth it as we tour Indonesian hospitality group PTT's stunning new Homely Hotel, designed by Dutch architects OMA. Monocle's May issue is available to order at monocle.com or be wise and subscribe.
Welcome back. Still to come, we'll find out why Apple and Google are teaming up for the first time in history. And secondly, we'll be looking at the newspapers. But first, there are many examples, such as South Korea, which have been using the lockdown. And as used, one country which has proved exemplary on the world stage is Taiwan. In the last 24 hours, it's reported no new coronavirus cases. Just the latest achievement for a self-ruled island's health officials who acted quickly to stop the spread of COVID-19 at the end of last year. It's even more impressive given Taiwan's close proximity to the Chinese mainland where the outbreak began. So how did they do it? Well, a little earlier, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck was joined by Representative David Lin from Taiwan's UK office. He also served as Taiwan's foreign minister between 2012 and 2016. Andrew began by asking David what Taiwan did so well to control the infection.
Currently, the coronavirus pandemic situation in Taiwan is under control. So far, we have had less than 400 confirmed cases and only 6 deaths. And most of them actually were imported cases from overseas. But we are still monitoring the situation because the pandemic around the world is not over yet. But in fighting the coronavirus pandemic, I think it's very important to take all necessary measures very quickly and as early as possible in order to control the spread of the virus. That means we need quick action, rapid response, and early deployment. In building an effective prevention system. I'll give you 2 examples. For instance, by the end of 2019, exactly December 31st, Taiwan already started to check passengers arriving from Wuhan for symptoms of fever and pneumonia. And then, very soon, on 20th of January this year, our government activated the Central Epidemic Command Center. So that's the Central Command Center to directly coordinate and integrate measures taken by relevant government agencies in combating the pandemic. So we have taken various measures in a very timely and integrated manner.
Is that because you had been through these epidemics before? You had a sense of knowing what was coming, whereas European nations didn't?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. So because we have taken a lot of measures, and many countries actually are doing more or less the same. But as I said, I think the most important thing is timing and a sense of urgency. Because we have gone through the period in 2003 in dealing with the SARS outbreak. So we know how to get started, how to prepare, you see, for such a pandemic. So we have set up in a very timely way a more effective practice, mainly because our experience. And we feel that the system is working very well. We hope that, you see, we will continue to do that.
Now, we have news that President Trump has withdrawn funding for the World Health Organization. Now, there have been many people who have been very critical of the organization for its refusal to take hints from yourself that this outbreak was about to happen, because you rang some early warning bells as a country. What's your feeling about the role of the World Health Organization and how it's responded to Taiwan?
Yeah, we certainly feel the WHO is still a very important international body dealing with health-related issues. In fact, Taiwan notified the WHO on the 31st of December 2019 so about the possibility of human-to-human transmission of coronavirus, but we received no response. The WHO didn't pay much attention to that. And then, you see, as you can see, the WHO announced an emergency as late as January 30th. And, of course, the announcement of a pandemic actually is also sometime even later. So we have tried to do the best we can to maintain our contact with the WHO. But again, you see, as we all know, the WHO has excluded Taiwan because of China's pressure and boycott. We feel that this is very unfair and unjust to the 24 million people of Taiwan, because health is a fundamental human right, and health for all actually is the basic goal of the WHO. We feel that there should be no loophole. Taiwan should be included. Taiwan should be incorporated in the international public health system. So we did see some delay. So we are hoping there will be maybe better efforts by the WHO to counter this pandemic.
Do you think the world would be not experiencing what it's going through now if they had listened to you back in December?
We feel that if the WHO took action a little bit earlier, probably the situation would be much better now for the entire world. But again, you see, we have not, you see, try to criticize or to have, you see, a negative comment, you see, on the WHO, especially the Director General. We still hope the WHO can do a good job.
And finally, just tell me, in Taiwan, what is life now like for Taiwanese? With so few cases, is life pretty normal? I presume that international travel is more controlled, but within the island, is life carrying on pretty much untouched?
Within the island, I think that people are leading normal lives. Business is as usual. We do have, you see, some travel restrictions, travel bans, especially for people coming from seriously affected areas. But in Taiwan, basically, we are doing well. We are hoping the economy will not be affected seriously. We are hoping that we can really share our experiences with other countries. Actually, our president has also made it very clear. So we are willing and ready to cooperate with other countries in fighting the coronavirus pandemic. Actually, we have already done that. Maybe you have noticed that Taiwan has already donated 10 million medical face top masks to other countries, including the UK. So we are hoping we can play a very important part to coordinate and cooperate with other countries in fighting this pandemic.
That was Representative David Lin from Taiwan's UK representative office talking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. Still to come on today's programme, we send a love letter to a city fighting hard against coronavirus, that's New York, plus a review of the newspapers and the latest business news too. But first, with the time 7:30 a.m. here in London, a quick look now at some of the other world news headlines on Monocle 24. Asia's economic growth this year will grind to a halt for the first time in six decades. That's according to the International Monetary Fund. The organisation warns the coronavirus crisis has taken an unprecedented toll on the region's service sector and major export destinations. President Donald Trump has said the US has passed the peak of new coronavirus cases and that he'll announce guidelines for lifting the US lockdown later. It's unclear what data he relies on in making such an assessment. And Médecins Sans Frontières are for the first time working in Canada to help homeless people infected with coronavirus. The medical charity usually works in developing countries or war zones, but a 400-bed facility will open in Toronto to help the city's 10,000 homeless people. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. So while staying put, we've asked our bureau chiefs and editors to think about what they most value about where they live in their respective cities. Monocle's America's editor at large, Ed Stocker, tells us now how he'd like to wake up the city that never sleeps from its current dormant state, New York. Here he is.
New York is known as the city that never sleeps. Except that's not quite true at the moment. The city might not be out cold, but it's in a deeply dormant state. Manhattan is deserted as the cultural offerings that make the city so lively have shut down. New York has always had narcotic properties for some, and it has never been a case of sitting on the fence. You're either a lover or a hater. What gets you is the buzz of business, the sense that something extraordinary or unusual could happen to you, even as the city has become more elite, and the notion that great success, whether social or financial, is just around the corner. To see that stifled in recent weeks is hard, but it's also completely clear to me that this city will bounce back. And while the current situation is unprecedented, the Big Apple has weathered blizzards before, from September the 11th to Hurricane Sandy. So what do I want to see return? Normalcy, of course. From a personal viewpoint, I want to be cycling into Manhattan, seeing a film at Nighthawk Cinema, and going to the Studio 54 exhibition at Brooklyn Museum that was due to open in March. But more than that, I want to see the city imperfectly humming as before. I want to see the curry houses of Jackson Heights full again, the Russians and Ukrainians of Brighton Beach strutting their stuff on the boardwalk as the weather warms, and the West Village bars and restaurants heaving. I think I may even want to see the tourists come back. When everything does return to normal, I'm certain there will be one hell of a party. Why do I care? Because New York is a flawed but great city, a place you sometimes long to leave but always miss when you're not there, and it has somehow managed to capture my heart.
And our thanks there to Monocle's America's editor at large, Ed Stocker. For more love letters from our bureau chiefs and correspondents, download the latest edition of The Urbanist. Next, though, a flip through the morning papers on Monocle 24. And to go through today's newspapers, joining me on the line is Ian Anderson, former political advisor and chairman of the international communications agency Cicero Group. Welcome back, Ian. Good to have you on the line with us today. Let's begin with the New York Times. Donald Trump's opening up council isn't very open.
That's right. And it's good to be back with you, Emma. So New York Times talking about really, I think, what's going to be the big story of the next epic Trump press conference. Some of these press conferences are going on for about 2.5 hours. I caught last night's, and the only thing that stopped Trump was the fact that the weather was rather cold, so he cut it rather short. But the New York Times talks today about a council of business leaders, scientists, experts that are being brought together to feed into the president the best kind of plans and policies to open up the economy. The only slight problem was that a lot of those business leaders and experts only found out that they were on the council when Trump announced their names from the podium. They didn't have any prior warning whatsoever. It's sort of another classic sort of Trumpian example of kind of not quite making policy up on the hoof, perhaps, but certainly putting things together pretty rapidly without an awful lot of consultation. But he's absolute priority. You can feel this. You've felt this for days now, is to try and move ahead of the medical advice and really get the American economy opened up as quickly as he can.
And this opens all kinds of problems, given the fact that the medical advice is to stay put. I mean, what do businesses, or what should businesses do when you have the White House saying go and everyone else saying no, not yet?
Well, you know, literally, of course, what businesses are going to be only able to do is not necessarily follow the president's advice. Even Trump has had to admit himself that on a state-by-state basis, it's actually governors that will have the power, that have the power to be able to allow return to work to take place. So, at the national level, of course, Trump in an election year wants to be seen to be leading, wants to be seen to be sort of pulling the governors towards opening up America. But businesses, state by state, are going to be listening to what governors have to say. Probably the most prominent of those, Cuomo in New York, he's had almost as much exposure as Trump has had with his own daily press conferences. And it does look like Cuomo is also moving towards the idea of opening up, not least because the states are just like businesses. They're finding their budgets completely shot. In fact, I think New Jersey reported overnight that it is literally run out of money.
Let's move on to an article in The Sun here in the United Kingdom suggesting that latte at the end of the tunnel. I mean, it's a slightly heavy sentence. It's a slightly heavy headline to suggest that coffee shops and estate agents and restaurants will be the first things to reopen when easing lockdown restrictions. What an odd choice.
It's a very, very odd choice, just on the sort of face of it. But if we remember, certainly here in the UK, which has had a slightly more liberal approach towards lockdown than in some other European states. I was obviously looking at what Germany's been talking about, what Merkel's been talking about overnight too. And coffee shops were one of the last sort of venues to close, albeit on a takeaway only basis. And really what The Sun is pointing to here is this idea that rather than by age or by geography, the UK economy is likely to be opened up on a sort of sector by sector basis. Now, coffee shops, well, again, that's probably going to be a takeaway basis. Estate agents, the thinking there is that because the property market is such an important driver of confidence and spending, they want to get the property market moving as fast as possible. Certainly, no likelihood of the UK opening up, I think, until around about the time that France is due to open up in the early part of May.
What I found really interesting about this article is not what it was about, but how it is now in the public domain. Yesterday, we had Labour's leader, Sir Keir Starmer, saying to the government, what's your plan? Why are you being so quiet? Is this because you don't know what you're going to do to ease the lockdown, or you're just being secretive about it? And yet there have been so many instances when it has been from the media that we have found out what the government's plans are, either to increase the lockdown or to ease restrictions.
Well, that's right. I mean, the media has almost been the official opposition, not just here in the UK, but actually in many countries while parliaments have been locked up. Now, I think there are two things that are going to start to change that. Firstly, parliaments are starting to come back across the world in a kind of virtual way. You know, we're starting to hear that country by country. And the UK Parliament is set to open up, albeit digitally, with MPs working remotely from next week. The other thing, of course, that's happening in the UK is the Labour Party has a new leader. That new leader, Keir Starmer, is probably going to be a much more effective interrogator of the Conservative government. And well, when that parliament does get back, you know, let's see whether or not the balance shifts back to the politicians holding governments to account rather than journalists.
You've worked for a very, very long time in communications and political communications. I mean, the fact that the main stories are coming out from the press and not from Number 10, what does that suggest about the way things are going?
Well, this is ebbed and flowed now all across the piece. You know, the sort of start of this, lots of governments seem to be on the back foot, lots and lots of very, very, very conflicting messages. I mean, when people went into lockdown, there was a sense of what are we actually being asked to do? It took time for governments to properly get up to speed in terms of their communication strategy. Now, you know, if you don't understand or hear the message, stay home, protect your health service. I mean, you're hearing that in Europe. You're hearing that in North America too. If you haven't heard those messages, then you're not probably looking at any media whatsoever right now. Maybe that is a good thing to do. Maybe it's a good idea just to carry on and not look at any of it as we move through lockdown. But no, it's taken a while for public policy and for governments to get the right messages. Those messages are now so crystal clear. The challenge now is how do you open up economies without creating mixed messages along the way?
One person who seems to have been a sort of shining light through all this, and indeed the government in the Downing Street press briefing yesterday paid tribute to this one man, a 99-year-old former army major who tried to raise a few thousand pounds for walking around his garden, is now raising millions.
Well, this is extraordinary. I mean, he's on the of virtually every single newspaper here in the UK. Britain salutes our 10 million NHS heroes, the one I'm looking at in the Express, but he's gone global. He's kind of gone viral. And in fact, he's raised more than 10 million. He's on the way to raising about 12.5 million. It's the largest amount of money that's ever been raised on the Just Giving platform. It's all going to go to the National Health Service here in the UK. And you know, it's a sort of, it really is a bright spot. It's a moment of hope. And I think that's part of the reason, not just that, he's got a tremendous personality as he's walking up and down his garden trying to raise this money, but it's a moment for us all to savor. His catchphrase is, tomorrow will be a better day. And you know what? That probably captures the zeitgeist of how everybody wants to feel right now.
We're talking about Captain Tom Moore, a former World War II veteran, who has basically just walked around his garden. And this £10 million, it's all going to NHS charities, isn't it?
It's all going to NHS charities. National Health Service has been front and centre in terms of the nation's thoughts and the health battle that is the fundamental part of this right now. And I mean, I've donated myself. I'm sure there are countless people listening this morning that have donated to Captain Tom. As I say, it really is something to savour, something to celebrate at a time when we've all felt rather gloomy and rather dark.
Ian Anderson, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. This is The Globalist, and in a moment, the business news. So stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk business now with the financial analyst Louise Cooper. Louise, welcome back. We heard the headlines earlier on about the fact that 60 years of continued economic growth in Asia has stopped.
So this is a warning, another one. We're almost getting these economic warnings daily, but this is another warning from the IMF. It was deep warning about the global economy earlier in the week. Today it's the term of Asia. And as you said, in 60 years, the Asia-Pacific region has never contracted. It has grown and grown and grown and grown, even during the Asian financial crisis, even during the global financial crisis. And yet the pandemic will cause that 60 years of continuous growth to come to an end. Now, unlike great swathes of the world, it's not expected to contract this year, but it's basically shuddered to a halt. And even China, you know, a country that delivered 6-7% growth, pretty much, you know, guaranteed, the growth, the IMS forecast for Chinese growth is now just above 1%. That is extraordinary for China. And you do not underestimate the impact that that growth is going to have on household income, or that lack of growth is going to have on household income. So this morning, for example, we've got in Thailand, the government is giving out $160 of cash, not a lot, but $160 of cash handouts to those in the lower paid informal sectors. You know, tourism has collapsed. You know, Thailand is very dependent on tourism. And out of 20 million that applied for the cash, only 9 million have got it. And therefore, there's these huge gatherings and protests outside the finance ministry. Not what you want to see. But this is the scale of the problem in poor countries, that many people work in very unstable jobs with very unstable income on extremely low wages. They are not far away from starvation. And this is kind of one of the problems, that when you see this big hit to economic growth and it disappears entirely, that there is a lot of pain and misery in individual households behind it.
One thing that the IMF also warned about was the fact that when the world comes out of this pandemic, there is every single chance that there will be a second wave.
And so this, again, is the problem. The second wave of infections, which, if I'm dredging in my memory, during the Spanish flu of the early part of last century, it was actually the secondary infection, I believe, that killed more than the first infection.
Let's move on to, again, after you talked about terrible economic data in Asia. Shall we just head over to the United States and kick that around as well?
Oh, some just appalling numbers coming out of America. And this is with a $2.2 trillion stimulus package, three times larger than the American economy got during the global financial crisis. The numbers are horrendous. So yesterday we had US retail sales down 8.7% in March compared to February. Frankly, it could have been worse. Biggest decline since records began in 1992. US factory output in March down 6.3%, the month on month, biggest decline since 1946. I could go on. Today is the day again for these weekly jobless figures. These are the numbers that now everybody is focusing on very, very carefully. These are these Department of Labor figures released, how many people have applied for some sort of you know, unemployment benefit in America, there's been horrendous numbers. I mean, you know, 5 million last week. It's expected about 5.5 million are going to have applied in 1 week, in just the last week, to something like 20 million Americans will have applied for unemployment welfare in 4 weeks. You know, we've got an unemployment rate that's gone from 3.5% in America up to almost 20% literally in weeks. And now some say the unemployment rate could get to 30%. Truly appalling numbers with great misery behind them.
Lots of people are, for very obvious reasons, now looking to the state for help, either through loans or through grants or what have you. But there has been huge criticism, both in the United States and here in the United Kingdom, that all these promises that have been given by the authorities for loans and bailouts just haven't turned up.
So the problem for politicians is structuring the policy correctly. You want it to get to the people that need it, the cash, the businesses and the households, as quickly as possible. But on the other hand, you don't want loads of, you know, billions or of dollars or pounds being given to multi-billionaire business owners that don't need the money or fraud. So this is the thing. And they're making up policy literally within days. So this is always the problem. And here in the UK, there's been huge criticism of a £330 billion government loan guarantee scheme for small and medium-sized companies because less than a billion has been given out. Well, that's hopeless. That's less than a third of 1%. And in fact, for the household support, the government here in the UK has had to go back and tweak the rules because there were too many families falling between the cracks. But if you look in the States, and there's been lots of criticism of Trump's $2.2 trillion package because of lack of oversight. Where is the money going? And one of them, you know, I just talked about these huge rise in unemployment. One of the big protections is a paycheck protection program, giving small businesses money to stop them laying off staff. Now, we know 20 odd million people have been laid off, and yet at the same time, the $350 billion scheme has pretty much given out all its money in 2 weeks, and no one knows where it's gone to. So there's a big question, where is this government, these huge numbers of government's money going, and is it going to protect American jobs? Because it's supposed to, but it doesn't seem to be.
Louise Cooper, thank you, as always, for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. Finally, one of the benefits, if we could even contemplate them, of the coronavirus has been the temporary laying down of arms between mortal enemies in the pursuit of a common goal. Two such rivals are Apple and Google. They have been working on a system to enable widespread contact tracing in an effort to contain COVID-19. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Josh Coles, researcher in the ethics of data at the Alan Turing Institute here in London. Josh, welcome back to Monocle 24. Just explain how this will work between Apple and Google.
Yes, so what Apple and Google have announced is the release of various steps to enable greater interoperability between their two very popular mobile phone systems, iOS and Android. And basically, this allows the systems, at least in the first instance, to play nice with each other. Clearly, both you know, people have both kinds of phones, and any attempt to trace and track people's contacts around physical space to try and get a sense of who's met who and who's potentially been infected will rely on some ability for these different devices to talk to each other. Now, Apple is well known for its stances on user privacy, perhaps more so than Google. But the joint announcement does suggest that they found some common ground on this.
So how is it going to work? I mean, between them, they've got pretty much every smartphone on Earth covered, haven't they? But let's say I have coronavirus. How does my phone then warn other people?
So there's various different ways this can happen. In the early stages of the virus in China and South Korea and other places, data such as GPS and cell data was used to identify you and where you'd been. And in China, it was even linked to a national database. Now, clearly, that poses some serious challenges for privacy. So the more recent approaches that have been developed more in Europe have been to use Bluetooth, which is inherently less privacy invading. And this can just tell you if you or really your device has been in contact with other devices. So that if you and I had had met then and you developed symptoms a few days later, at that point, depending on the system used, some sort of database would be able to tell you and me, or tell me that I've been in contact with you, just based on our kind of low-range Bluetooth signals that have been sent to each other. So less about kind of location per se, and more about the contact between our two devices.
How do two such huge rivals like Apple and Google work together?
Well, it's clearly been a big effort. The almost identical statements posted on both companies' websites does speak to a high degree of agreement on this. I think clearly behind the scenes there have been a lot of debates over how these systems should work. But there is a common goal, as I say, to not only to enable this really powerful technology to really weaponize the devices we have in our pockets against the virus, but also to encompass some things which some of these companies have been perhaps a little lacking in recent years around privacy, transparency, anonymity and consent and things like that. So they really do seem to have perhaps learnt from previous blunders over the last 5 years. I suspect if this virus had emerged 5 years earlier, they might be a little bit more cavalier with the moves they're taking. But really, it seems like they're pretty close to more or less the gold standard when it comes to trying to protect these core values as we fight the virus.
Well, as they're protecting the core values, they're obviously sharing an awful lot of information about how they work and how their systems work. How do you go back to being a rival with your mortal enemy once this is all over?
It's an interesting question. I suppose in some ways it's a bit easier for these two, given that they both have large shares, as you say, of the smartphone market. And they'll probably fit quite comfortably, I think, back into that rivalry position. It is worth saying that actually in their early stages, particularly in Google's early stages, there was quite a friendly relationship between the two companies. I think there was some shared board occupation, that kind of thing, between the different executives. That all shifted, I think, chiefly with the release of the iPhone and then the Android operating system in the middle of the last decade. So I think that has set relations back, certainly. I'm sure core business interests dictate that they will be competitors when this is all over. But there is a bit of common feeling, which perhaps you might not find between Google and Facebook, but of course it's just speculation.
One thing that seems to be the sort of like the missing link in all this is it's fantastic that Apple and Google are talking to each other, and the info is great to have, picking up from low-level Bluetooth signals, but it doesn't mean anything unless there is an infrastructure of testing and government intervention here to make sure that this thing actually works.
Yeah, that's the ground truth, really. And even if the system itself works absolutely perfectly, without that ability for some user who thinks they have symptoms to get tested and to verify that they have coronavirus, it will really limit the spread or the success of the apps in tackling the spread of the disease. So there is, I think, a real human challenge and policy challenge for governments to not just kind of ride off the back of technology such as this, but to use it in the most appropriate way and to back it up on their side of the bargain with a massive increase in testing and, of course, other resources needed to tackle the virus. So this is, a technical component of a solution rather than a technical solution per se.
Josh Coles, thank you very much indeed, as ever, for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all my guests, and thanks to our producers too, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Ribello and Marcus Hippie. Our researcher was Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager was Nora Hoyle. After the headlines, more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.